On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail. But what about the promise to build the wall and make Mexico pay for it? What about the promise?
There's no longer an onus for the candidates to take substantive stands.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Anyone can see that there's a real estate bubble.
Actually, no one can see a bubble. That's what makes it a bubble.
That's dumb, Lawrence. It's always markers. Mortgage fraud, quintupled since 2000, and the average take-home pay. It's flat, but home prices are soaring. That means the homes are debt, not assets.
So Mike Burry, a guy who gets his hair cut at Supercuts and doesn't wear shoes, knows more than Alan Greenspan and Hank Paulson.
Yeah, Dr. Mike Burry. Yes, he does.
Christian Bale there playing Mike Burry in The Big Short. Burry's the unorthodox hedge fund manager who predicted the financial bubble bursting. He made a whole lot of money off that. Well, the average hedge fund lost money for investors last year, and still, the top 25 American hedge fund managers raked in $13 billion. That's more than the entire economies of many countries, countries like Nicaragua, like Namibia. One reason, a tax loophole. It's something all three presidential candidates want to eliminate, and yet President Obama hasn't done so. To talk about why, we've called up veteran business journalist Heidi Moore. Welcome back, Heidi.
It's good to be back. Hi.
Hi. Well, some of these hedge fund managers made nearly $5 million a day. Mm-hmm. Just cogitate on that one. What exactly do they do to earn that kind of money?
Well, hedge fund managers have a very vague job description. Basically, what they do is they move money around. And to the extent that they can do that very wisely, i.e., meaning that they invest in certain things better than other people, they can make a profit on it. But there's a huge variety of investment styles that they're paid for. So anything from as simple as stocks and bonds, which most people might be familiar with, to investing in commodities like oil, to the economies of rising countries like India, basically almost anything. And of course, one of the things that a lot of them have been using very recently is computer algorithms. And so some of them are just very good programmers, essentially, or have very good programmers working for them who know how to read the stock market and then make money on the pennies that are left over as stocks move.
So how are they different from regular fund managers, you know, like the people who manage my retirement fund?
Yeah, they're very, very different. So the people who manage your retirement fund are actually heavily regulated, right? So the government has been watching over that business, the business of mutual funds and 401ks, basically since the 1930s. And hedge funds they're not unregulated, but they are largely operating outside of the heavy oversight that mutual funds have. So they can basically do whatever they want. They only recently had to register their names and their addresses, and they fought that. Hell. So they basically, they can do whatever they want. And the freedom of it is that they're serving what are called sophisticated investors, which means rich investors. So you and I couldn't just put money in a hedge fund. You'd have to be somebody with well over $1 million in assets and probably closer to 10, 15, 20 million.
Okay. So this loophole everyone's talking about is called the carried interest tax loophole. What is that?
So it's a loop. People call it a loophole, but it's not a bug. It's a feature of our tax system. So what it does is that it says that if you are involved in an investing business, your taxes on your profits will be only 15%, as opposed to the usual tax rate, which is 35%. And the reason that it's called carried interest. And the reason for that is that the assumption is that if you are investing money, this was first designed for real estate, that when you make profits on it, it's an encouragement for you to take risk. So the government wanted to encourage people to take risks on businesses and real estate that may not work out. And the way that they did it was they came up with this incentive saying, okay, well, if you take this risk of losing money and you actually make money, then we'll only tax you on it at 15%.
Okay, so the three candidates, as I mentioned, want to get rid of it, and they say this could bring in billions of dollars in revenue. Why hasn't the current president, Obama, gotten rid of it?
Well, you know, first of all, it's very hard to get rid of, right? Because if you think about campaign donations, where are they coming from? They're coming from people who make a lot of money on carried interest. They're coming from, you know, guys who run private equity firms, hedge fund managers, from corporate chieftains, from people who make their money on real estate. So all of these people are benefiting from that 15% tax rate. And, you know, when it's time for them to make donations to a campaign, they're not going to fund the campaign that threatens to take away their tax break, right? So a lot of members of Congress end up conflicted about the issue. And so it's never going to go through Congress. And that's the only way you can change it.
Oh, because I think there's some dispute over that, whether or not the president could actually do it unilaterally or whether he'd have to go through Congress.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he could try unilaterally, right? But it would create, for something this big, it would create a lot of resentment. It's essentially like changing the tax code yourself. I mean, it really would be better if he had more popular support, which of course he's not going to get from Congress. So, you know, one could argue maybe the end justifies the means, that getting rid of this, you know, what many people consider this unfair tax loophole, is worth any method required. But generally, you know, in Congress, this is why we have checks and balances, right? So that one person can't push their agenda through alone.
Right. Although he did enact something where he forced companies, I forgot what the exact rule is called, but something about their headquarters being overseas, and he eliminated that unilaterally.
Well, that was through the Treasury. Yeah, that was through the Treasury and the IRS.
Right.
So they can do that, but that didn't come, I mean, that wasn't from the White House itself.
But his administration.
Yeah, exactly. But so, you know, so the IRS could do it. I mean, if you could get the IRS and the Treasury behind something like this, you know, they could do it. But again, you know, it stirs up so many difficult issues. These are just the challenges. It's not to say that it shouldn't be done. But the challenge is, do you go ahead and do you enforce or create a rule that a lot of people have a say in? And do you do it yourself? Or do you actually try to put it to some kind of vote?
Mm-hmm. And so if you did get rid of it, would it have a big impact in terms of tax revenue?
Yeah, it would have a huge, huge impact. I mean, this is why a lot of money in our financial system at the highest levels gets invested, right? And that money is going to get invested no matter what, right? So the idea of it being an incentive to take risk is essentially ridiculous. It's no longer true. People take risk because it's the only way that they can make a reward, right? I mean, if you're mm-hmm. working on Wall Street, you have to take a risk to make money. So so they don't need an incentive, a tax incentive to take risk. It's not like they're going to stop investing money once they actually have to pay real taxes. So since the rationale behind it is so weak, which is something that even Larry Summers has said himself, the rationale behind it is so weak. So why don't they just, you know, kind of take care of it and, you know, and just clean up the tax system? I mean, there's a very good argument for getting rid of it.
So has there been any movement on Capitol Hill at all on this?
You know, it's been talked about again and again and again, and Obama himself brought it up. It was discussed as part of the Dodd-Frank bill, but eventually not put in at all because the industry fought it. So, you know, so now it's at the risk of the conversation happening so often that people are just fatigued, right? They don't want to hear about it anymore in Congress. There's nothing new. You know, there's nothing to force it through and no event that's happened, except that people who are running for president have realized that it's a very easy issue to run on, right? Because everyone dislikes this idea of a tax break for billionaires. So but that's not an event. That's just rhetoric. So unless there's an event, as there was with the thing about overseas companies, then maybe there might be some movement. Like with the overseas tax rule, what happened was there were a lot of mergers, and those mergers continually challenged the administration, and the administration said, we should shut this down. So unless you have something like that, like some direct challenge to the government, it's unlikely that the rules are going to change.
Great to talk to you, Heidi.
Great to talk to you, too.
That's Heidi Moore. She's a veteran business journalist, formerly with The Wall Street Journal and The Guardian. Well, while a few people are making a whole lot of money, the Pew Research Center has confirmed that yet again, the American middle class is shrinking. Yes, in most American cities, there are fewer people in the middle and more in the bottom and at the top. Manuel Pastor is professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC and a statistician. He joins me now. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
All right. So give us a sense of how significant the reduction is in the American middle class. What stands out to you in this Pew report?
Well, a couple of different things. One is that according to Pew, and they define the middle class as households that are about at the bottom line is two-thirds of the median income, and then the top line is twice the median income. So to give you kind of a ballpark for what that means, for a family of four, you would be considered middle class by Pew if your income was above $48,000 and less than about $140,000. So that's what they're defining as the middle class. What they find is that if you look from 1999 to the current period, that the middle class as a share of the United States actually fell from about 55% of households to just over 50% of households. So we're really nearing a situation in which less than half of the households would actually be considered middle class.
Less than half. And the report looked at 229 of America's biggest metro areas, and it said that they make up about 75% of the population. So that is obviously a big chunk of the U.S. population.
Well, it is. And also those 229 metropolitan areas are the major drivers. So they make up the share that you mentioned in terms of the population, but they make up between 80 and 90% of the GDP because it's metropolitan areas that tend to be the places where industries are growing and where economies are vibrant. So it's really a threat as well for economic prosperity because when the middle class is disappearing, that means less purchasing power in these metros, and it also leads to people abandoning public education systems and a lot of things that would wind up having negative impacts on economic growth and prosperity.
Although some of the vanishing middle class can be attributed to people moving up out of the middle class, not all down, right?
Well, yeah, really what Pew is trying to tell us, about half of the metropolitan areas, the decrease in the middle class was accompanied by an increase in both those moving to the top and an increase in terms of those moving into the bottom. So the way to think about this is a sort of hollowing out of the income distribution, less people in the middle, more people at the top, more people at the bottom. The innovation in the Pew study is to take this from the national level and drive it down to the local metros so we can look at what happened in the different metropolitan areas and what might be the causes in different metropolitan places for doing that. In the Midwest, the main cause is the loss of manufacturing and sort of middle-wage jobs. On the coast, the main cause has been the rise of financial services industries, high technology, and a lot of people moving up to the top, and an accompanying sort of growth at those at the bottom who basically fill in the service industries that service those who are in the financial and high tech industries.
So what's happening here in Los Angeles?
Well, Los Angeles is kind of interesting. If you look at the Pew study, you would say almost nothing is happening in Los Angeles. That is, the share of the middle class went down. It was lower in 1999 than it was in the nation as a whole. 55% of national households were considered middle class. About 47%, 47.3% of Los Angeles households. That's gone down to 46.5%, even though there was a big reduction at the national level. Why is that? California has traditionally been, not just demographically, but economically, America fast forward. So the widening divide that's now occurring in the nation occurred in California first, and it occurred in Los Angeles, sort of on steroids, even before that. So much of the hollowing out of our middle class actually happened in the 80s and the 90s as we lost a big manufacturing base in Los Angeles and also with the influx of immigrants who wound up being at the bottom end of the income distribution.
So looking at Los Angeles now, what does it tell you about where the rest of the country is going to be in 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, it's not good news because if the rest of the country continues to follow the U.S. trajectory, that means, again, as the Pew Center study was warning, that we're going to wind up with less than half of the households being considered middle class. Now, of course, there are some things that we can do to address these issues, and we're beginning to address some of them in Los Angeles, and hopefully that can begin to point the way for the rest of the nation as well. I put them into kind of three buckets. We've got to shore up the bottom of the labor market. We've got to grow the middle of the economy, and we have to tame the top. What does that mean? Things at the bottom are things like raising the minimum wage, comprehensive immigration reform, so people can have legal rights and therefore demand higher wages. Growing the middle means making sure that some of our manufacturing can come back. There's a lot of discussion about how to use the transit investments that are going to happen in the Los Angeles metropolitan area to generate more construction employment and also rail car assembly employment. And taming the top is exactly what you were talking about with the previous guest. If you've got a tax system so skewed so that hedge fund managers can make so much money, and we're not figuring out how to tax that appropriately and reinvest that in education and in growing the middle, we're not going to be able to address these conflicts. So again, I think it's shoring up the bottom, growing the middle, and taming the top.
And then also public education, investing in education, I imagine, would be key to that.
Well, I think that's both for the bottom and the middle. Unless you have an educated population, it's very difficult to have an economy that's functioning. And that does mean addressing our K through 12 and pre-K. Another critical linchpin, actually, though, is the community college system. In most areas of the United States now, the community college system is educating a large share of kids of color in particular, and also it articulates well with the workforce development needs of regions. When we look at a place like the Silicon Valley that actually has done pretty well, when people think about the education system there that they point to, they often think of Stanford and UC Berkeley. But a lot of people in the know point to the fact that they've got a rich, meaning well-resourced and high-performing community college system, which is preparing people to move on into even higher education, but it's also a place where people can retrain as industries shift. So we do need to invest in education at all levels. For economic growth and the middle class, community colleges are key.
Manuel Pastor is a professor of sociology and American studies and ethnicity at USC. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. We'd love to hear from you now. Have you been affected by the shrinking middle class? Are you a member of it? Do you notice friends and family struggling economically, or are they moving on up? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY and Twitter or Facebook as well at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the band Yacht said it was a victim of revenge porn, but that turned out to be a hoax, a PR scheme that went awry. We'll talk about that and new legislation about what happens to your online life after you die with Shani Jardin. She's here next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The very KCRW band Yacht created a crazy internet hoax this week to promote their new video. It did not end well. We're going to talk about that and other news of the interwebs with Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net. Hi there.
Hey, good to be here again.
Good to have you. So there was the sex tape posting. The non-apology apology.
With way too many adjectives.
And then the apology, the real apology. So take us back to the beginning for those of us who mercifully haven't followed this from the beginning.
So the plot that they described in this weird publicity grab was that they were the victims of essentially revenge porn. And then some music journalists, some music bloggers started pointing out that this seemed weird and suspect. And then they issued a real apology, which included lots of sort of fancy language, and it just seemed, the whole thing seemed contorted and awkward from the beginning to the very, very embarrassing end. I think even more embarrassing than having naked selfies or sex tapes of yourself leaked on the internet is for everybody to realize that you're a total phony and a fraud, and I feel like that's what these guys outed themselves
to
be.
But why did they apologize?
I mean, I guess because some people pointed out to the artists that it's incredibly tasteless and cruel to make fun of revenge porn. Mm. Here in California, you know, it was interesting. Last year, we, the state, convicted a notorious revenge porn operator, Kevin Bullard. In his case, this is a typical revenge porn case. There was one victim of many of his victims who was, they were a married couple, the wife and the husband, she started sending him naked selfies at his request to sort of spice up their marriage again. Somehow, something happened and her phone wasn't secure or something like that. And the revenge porn operator was sent a copy of the photos by someone. He posts them on the site, and then he says to her, if you'd like these taken down, ma'am, you'll have to pay me hundreds of dollars per image. So he had this very profitable racket. For women and children and, you know, guys too, everybody's body matters. But for all kinds of innocent people to be extorted in this way this is a really serious thing. And it's not, it's kind of like joking about rape.
Yeah.
Very
so,
few people
so
get
then
to joke
Yacht
about rape.
Really did apologize and said they didn't realize they were being so insensitive.
Yeah, but they used a word egregious, and they used the, like, I want to just ding them for their words. It was just,
and then they released their video.
It didn't seem legit, and then they released the video. The Yacht doth protest too much. The whole thing stinks to me.
Okay, let's move on, because that was a hoax, but getting, as you say, sexually exposed online is a real problem. Brookings Institution has issued a report saying there's this new threat. It's called sextortion. It's not exactly revenge porn because it's not about money. What is this?
So I think the Brookings Institution report gives us a new way of looking at how that kind of dynamic just metastasizes throughout the internet. So revenge porn involves there's a naked picture of you. I'm going to charge you money to remove it. Sextortion might involve other kinds of behavioral demands. I want you to do this or do that. And, you know, without getting into the icky triggering details, the point is that security, privacy, and how much you can really trust that your devices and your apps are going to provide you with the protection you expect. That's why, like all of these discussions we have about the weird politics and legalities of the FBI going after an iPhone, this is the kind of stuff that the hackers warn us about. That if you're not dealing with a secure phone, and if advertisers are allowed to place tracking cookies and adware on your device or your computer that observes you and observes your behavior more than you're aware of, this is the kind of stuff that can happen more and more, that can proliferate throughout our online culture.
Do you think that people should cover up the little camera on their laptops? Some people do that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't, and maybe I'm stupid, but I know very credible, very sober people who work at greater risk. Maybe they're public figures or hackers or people at the Electronic Frontier Foundation who fight over this sort of stuff in the courts. Many of those people do. And I don't think that's insane anymore.
You put a little electrical tape or something over it.
Yeah, you know what I think I'm going to do? I'm going to go down to Japantown later today and get like some glittery Hello Kitty stickers and just put them on everything. People have had enough of my selfies anyway, I think, with the dogs.
No, keep them coming.
Okay,
so speaking of law on the internet, California is considering new legislation about what happens to your Facebook and email accounts when you die.
This is an interesting issue that people have been kicking this around for a long time. So here in California and in other states and at the federal level also, people are talking about creating essentially what happens with your home and your physical property when you die, the same kind of legal structure around your digital detritus. Everything from your sects to the sexts to the unreleased Yacht sex tapes to maybe the great American novel that you tinkered away with after work every day for 10 years. Whose property is that after you're gone? Google and Facebook and other popular apps allow you to designate essentially a caretaker or somebody that inherits that using different kinds of legalese language.
Do you do that on the website or do you do it separately in a will?
What I'm saying is that Google and Facebook allow you to do that through your account setting. So I can say, guys, when the mothership comes for me, I want Madeline Brand to have all my Twitter drafts, all those sick jokes and those fantastic burns and the great comebacks to Donald Trump's stupid tweets. I give them to Madeline. She's the inheritor. there's talk here in California about creating a law that would define pretty strictly what that chain of command is if I flake and don't write the will, basically.
So what would happen?
Well, there have been different versions of this bandied about, and the version that's out right now, groups like the ACLU are saying, whoa, this is way too strict and could lead to people's speech essentially being silenced because somebody else in the mix has rights that they ought not to have.
Well, it's interesting because I think Facebook probably says, look, this is our property. It's on our site. So,
yes, exactly. This isn't stuff that's on a server in my home that I run myself. This is content that's on Facebook.com or Twitter.com or in the Snapchat servers, wherever they are, someplace offshore probably.
So this legislation would determine, would say, no, it's yours. It's ours.
Yeah.
It's my identity. Even though it's an online identity, it's still mine. It's not Facebook's.
Yeah, because I think these companies are realizing that taking any other position would result in so much public backlash.
Yeah.
They don't. This is a gray area. Is it Facebook's content or is it the deceased person? And if it belongs to the deceased person, which is kind of where things are going with these laws that are being fought out in the courts, then who gets that when the user dies? I think this is a great example of something that the USC scholar, I think she's now at UC Irvine, Mimi Ito, she studied a lot of youth mobile culture in Japan and here in the US. She talks about when new technologies come into a culture, at first there is a lot of upset, a lot of backlash, and then there is this battle to expand or contract, fights that happen in the court systems to legislate or not legislate, and then eventually things kind of even out. So I think we're sort of in the throes of figuring out how much this matters. And I think the answer is that we all agree it matters a lot. So how do we manage it?
Shani Jardin, always mattering here.
I'm not mad.
Madder than a hatter. Shani Jardin, co-editor of WangWing.net. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have a digital will? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, people have varied interests, yes they do, some, in their off hours like to dress up in animal suits.
That kind of unwritten rule is like if the jaw on your head moves, then you're allowed to talk and like speak with words, and if it doesn't, then you just kind of stay quiet.
Furries, who, what, and why? That's next on Press Play.
Check out KCRW's all news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There are lots of interesting ways that people like to spend their free time. There are bodybuilders, there are Civil War reenactors, people who play fantasy sports, and then there are the furries, a particular kind of fandom subculture that involves dressing up like a big, furry, anthropomorphized animal. From time to time, you can see a pack of them roaming around Griffith Park. A new documentary called Fursonas takes a closer look at the furry subculture and spends some quality time with Bandit, Chew Fox, Boomer the Dog, and other furries. It's directed by first-time filmmaker Dominic Rodriguez. He's here now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, it's great to have you on. And in the interest of full disclosure, we have to disclose that you yourself are a furry.
Yes, the secret is out.
The secret is out. But you don't identify yourself as a furry in the movie. And what is your fursona?
I am a wolf.
A wolf. Okay. Describe the furry phenomenon for people who aren't familiar.
So this is something that's been around since maybe the late 70s, early 80s. But lately it's kind of grown exponentially with the internet and after like the 90s, early 2000s. And the broadest way to put it is just people that are interested in anthropomorphic animals. So that's animals with human characteristics. That's kind of a boring way to describe it, though. And what's interesting about the furry fandom is how there's just so many people that are involved in it for so many different reasons. You see people that wear the suits a lot, so that's a very visual part of the community, but not everybody has suits, but it's just a very complicated thing. When you start to talk to more of them, you see how many different people do it for different reasons.
How many people are furries?
That's such a good question. My guess is like somewhere around 1 million. It's hard to like quantify that. But if I look at like how many people, for instance, have profiles on this website for Affinity, that's the number around there. So I'm thinking like maybe that's a good average.
And describe the appeal, because it sounds a lot like, you know, just dressing up and being able to assume another identity because you're hidden. You're inside this big costume. So it sounds like, it sounds like Halloween, kind of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I have a suit, and I like that aspect of it as well. It's kind of fun when you're around other people that are in suits, because you're getting to know each other and getting into these like weird adventures of like all day maybe you're hanging out with these people, and then when you go later and you take your heads off, it's like, oh, I didn't even know what these people looked like. So that's kind of an interesting experience that I think is unique maybe to this community.
Are people different people when they have their suits on?
Some people like won't use words, you know, some people will just bark at you or whatever like that. I talk a lot. It sort of depends on the kind of unwritten rule is like if the jaw on your head moves, then you're allowed to talk and like speak with words. And if it doesn't, then you just kind of stay quiet.
I see. Where did you get your suit?
I ordered it. They're all you commission them from specialty makers. Some people make them themselves. I don't have that kind of talent. So I paid for mine from a company called Made For You. And fur is F-U-R.
And are the suits expensive?
Some of them can be really expensive, yeah. Mine was like $2,000.
Oh, wow. And how often do you dress up?
As often as I can. Some people, you know, will do it only on special occasions at these events. Some people will do it around the house. I think most people kind of save it for sort of special occasions, but I've been getting out to more and more of these conventions. So, I mean, if I could do it, like, if I could go to a convention every month, I would.
But you don't just dress up and, you know, go outside and do your errands. You do it
no,
at a convention.
I don't
or,
do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like to be around other people doing it. I don't like to usually be the only one doing it.
Uh-huh. So you go to these conventions, everyone's dressed up, or a lot of people are dressed up in the suits. What happens at these conventions?
It sounds kind of boring when you describe it. When you go there, because we went to a couple furry conventions just to film. And the first conventions that I ever went to were just to film. And I remember thinking at the time, actually, because this was early on, like, I can't really get into this. Like, I don't understand. It's just them, like, walking around and hugging each other. And that's it. They're just, like, walking around. And it looks kind of boring. But it's sort of like when you know people, then it's much more fun to, like, oh, I haven't seen this person in, like, you know, a few years. Like, wow, how are you doing? And, like, catching up. There's, like, also kind of, it depends on who you are. Like, I'm more into the kind of partying kind of scene and just hanging out with my friends and just, like, there's, like, room parties. You know, some people, it's all about hooking up and having sex and stuff like that, and that's fine, too. So it's just kind of, like, a bunch of friends hanging out would be the best way to describe it. Oh, also there's panels. So that's the kind of daytime sort of stuff. At nighttime, I always make sure to go to like the dances because that's really fun, you know, to see a bunch of fursuiters like at a rave or something like that. That can be really cool. And so much of also the furry experience is online. So like people are discussing this stuff all the time. It's for people, it can be like a year long thing where they go online at night on Twitter and stuff and hang out and talk about all that stuff.
And how did you get into it?
Well, when I was younger, I was like 12 years old and I was interested in this stuff. And like people argue about like the best way to represent furry because people get into it for different reasons. I found porn online. So that's a huge element of it. Like there is like a sexual component for a lot of people. So that was my introduction to it. And so it was not something that I shared with other people because, you know, I was embarrassed by it. But then as I kind of saw the way the fandom was treated by the media and then the way the fandom was kind of talking about itself, it felt like nobody was really doing justice to this whole community since it was kind of complicated. And then over time, as I started working on the movie, I got more into other aspects of the community because I met people and I made friends with people. So there's a lot of ways to enjoy it.
So is it a lot different than cosplay?
I think that it's really similar to cosplay in the sense that, you know, you're putting on a costume a lot of the time and you're role playing. But what's different about it, and I do think it's different, is that there's a stronger sense of identity in the furry community in the sense that, like, I don't know, it's just really important to a lot of people. And the fact that people don't say, like, I am a cosplayer. I mean, they say that, but it's not with the same kind of enthusiasm that they say, I am a furry. You know, it's like kind of defines who they are. And I think it's like that for a lot of people.
So it's an identity. It's who you
I think
are.
So.
It's
yeah,
not just dressing
absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely. I mean, usually there's an element of like performance to it, I guess. But then there's this kind of cool paradox in how by putting on this costume and assuming this different identity, it's also kind of a window into sort of maybe who you really are, you know, and it allows you to be less inhibited and express sort of maybe a truer side of yourself as well. So that's interesting. Like when I do it, I talk a lot, right? So like I just kind of talk more and louder and more obnoxiously.
So what is it besides the costume?
I think it's the people that you meet. I think it all is about creating this atmosphere of kind of openness and acceptance. Like somebody like Boomer the dog is a great example of somebody that if I saw him just on TV or something, I would have been like, well, this looks like a crazy person. But then I met him and he's changed my life because he's got a lot of insight and now I consider him a friend. And so those are the kind of connections that I make in this community. It's just like about the people that you meet.
But is it possible to be a furry and not have fur? Like, can you be a snake or
yeah,
like that?
The scalies would be sort of that's like a term, but it's also it all falls under the umbrella of furry. Uh-huh. Like you can be a dragon, you can be a cockroach, you can be anything your heart desires.
Okay, there was an article written a while ago about furries in Vanity Fair, and I just want to read you a paragraph and get your reaction. It says, there are many kinds of furries, but they all seem to have a few things in common. Something happened to them after a youthful encounter with Bugs Bunny or Scooby-Doo or the mascot at the pep rally. They took refuge in cartoons or science fiction. After being bombarded by tigers telling them what cereal to eat, camels smoking cigarettes, cars named after animals, airplanes with eyes and smiles, shirts with alligators, they decided their fellow human beings were not nearly so interesting as those animal characters. Does that capture at all your experience?
I think, yeah. I mean, a lot of it's like growing up with a lot of that media surrounding you, and then especially with the internet. It's like, you know, growing up with like also for me, for my generation, like growing up in kind of the Disney golden age, you know, with things like The Lion King and things like that kind of all swarming around in your head, and then going onto the internet and growing up with that and then finding other people that are into that stuff. So I'd say that's true. That article is a like universally hated piece of media as far as furries go. They hate that article.
Why?
I don't think it's that bad personally. I think it's kind of a sympathetic piece. It's just because it focused a lot on sex, and I think people in the community get really sensitive when you start talking about that stuff.
But you said yourself that's how you got into it.
Exactly.
How many people got into it through sex?
I do not know the number because even if people are being completely honest with you, you have to ask yourself, like, am I surrounding myself with people that are like me, or am I really getting to know everybody and their perspective? Hmm. So I don't know. I think a lot of people get into it for that reason and a lot of people don't. And I really can't say whether it's more people that do that or don't.
So there's a good portion of the movie on the leader of the movement. He's known as Uncle Kage, and his real name is Samuel Conway, and he's always wearing a white lab coat, it seems, drinking a glass of wine. And he talks a lot about the media, about how the media mischaracterizes furries. Do you agree with him?
I don't agree with him. I mean, I understand where he's coming from because he wants to protect the image of furries and have them seen as a force of good. But I just think he has an unrealistic expectation for how we're going to be perceived. Like, no matter what, like, some people are going to think that this is weird because it looks weird. And I disagree with him because he thinks that the media is out to get us. Like, he thinks that, you know, they're trying to smear us and give us a bad name. And I don't think that's true at all. Like, I think media is just focusing on what's interesting. And that's what media has always done. And I think that if in the furry fandom we don't care as much and we kind of chill out, then we'll see that this doesn't really make that much of a difference. And like efforts to kind of suppress what people say and try really hard to get this perfect image, I think, are only going to be counterproductive.
Well, I mean, it's designed to get attention, right? I mean, here you are in public wearing a gigantic fur costume. So so people are going to look.
And then you're angry when they look at you.
Yeah.
Which is what's funny.
I mean, it's a little weird, right?
It is. Yes, absolutely. It's ironic.
So what is it that the furries want?
I think they want to be taken seriously, but then also maybe not too seriously. I think they want people to understand the truth. And the screwed up thing about that is it's a different truth for so many different people. And like, no matter how I made this movie, I would be alienating some members of this community because they feel like, well, you're not representing my experience, and my experience is the most important thing in the world to me. So all I can do is sort of acknowledge my bias and try to clarify for people that this is not supposed to be the definitive study on this community. And I hope it just opens up conversations for people to look at this more.
Dominic Rodriguez is the director of the new documentary, Fursonas. It's available on demand now.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Coming up, after the Oscars' So White embarrassment, Hollywood is now making a lot more movies about Black subjects by Black directors and starring Black actors. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Next year, we may see a new hashtag during awards season, Oscars So Black. More than a dozen films starring Black actors by Black filmmakers and on Black issues are set for release before the end of this year. And the studios backing these movies are hoping they become Oscar contenders. Michael Sipley is writing about this in the New York Times, and he's here now. Hi.
Yeah. Hello, Madeline.
Okay, so the last 2 years saw an all-white lineup of Oscar nominees for all of the acting categories. And so the movie studios, are they pretty much in full damage control mode now?
Well, they are that. But I think probably the better way to look at it is that the pressure of those last 2 years is driving what definitely looks like a wave right now. And it's coming in quite fast. And the odd thing is that it's really just returning them to form. It's taking them back to exactly where they were in 2013. That was the year that 12 Years a Slave was released and a lot of Black pictures.
Hmm. So, but it seems like a lot more, just reading your article, a lot more in development now.
It's almost identical. We had a story 2 years ago that ran almost to the day, 2 years, you know, almost to the month, that said virtually the same thing. The numbers were about the same. There was a very strong wave coming in then. There's a very strong wave coming in now. And the real peculiarity, what nobody's quite worked out, is why there seemed to be something of a hiatus in what had been a 10 or 12 year pattern.
What are the ideas about that?
Well, I have personally some very strong ideas about it, and I don't know whether everybody at the Academy would agree, but you know, if you look at the decade that led up to I guess it was 2014, the year that 12 Years a Slave won. In the acting categories, Black nominees and Black actors figured in exactly their proportion of the North American population. You know, they count North American box office viewership, and it was identical. There was no variation. It was a very strong run of films, performances, and awards. Suddenly, in the acting categories, dropped off for 2 years, where you had two all-white years. And I think it had an awful lot to do with the fact that the Academy, for more than 5 years, and the film business for about 10 years, has been strongly internationalizing. And that has one unseen or unintended consequence, and that's that international audiences don't respond, and I'm going to assume international voters don't respond quite as strongly to specifically African-American stories. I'm not saying Black, but African-American, as what American audiences and voters do.
So basically, an audience in Europe or an audience in China doesn't want to see a drama about the slave era.
You know, sometimes they break through, but I've been looking at this for a long, long time, and every once in a while I put the dipstick in, and it always looks pretty much the same with rare exceptions. An African-American story, let's put it differently, a typical studio movie, particularly a blockbuster-type movie, is going to get something like 70% or more of its money from abroad now. Okay, it's way over half. And black-driven films and African-American-driven films tend to linger down around 15, 20, sometimes they get out to 30%, so that when a studio goes into that zone, they have to adjust expectations, and it just becomes a tougher green light for pure economic reasons.
All right, one of the movies that did get the green light is Birth of a Nation, directed by and starring Nate Parker. It's set in 1830s Virginia. It's about the Nat Turner slave rebellion. Here's a clip from that movie.
Brethren, I pray you sing a new song. Sing praise in the assembly of the righteous. Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let the high praise of God be on the mouths of the saints and a two-edged sword in their hands to execute vengeance on the demonic nations and punishments on those peoples, to bind their kings with chains. Dishonor have all his saints. Praise the Lord. Praise the Lord. Sing to him a new song.
Okay, a clip from Birth of a Nation that was picked up at Sundance this year by Fox Searchlight. It was the subject of an intense bidding war, and I believe Fox Searchlight paid the most ever for a Sundance movie. Are you saying, though, that it's not going to do well because foreign audiences won't?
That's not 100% true. It's likely to do very well domestically because Fox Searchlight, which released 12 Years a Slave, is really committed to this movie. The movie probably will travel better than the average black-driven film abroad because they did a little better than the average with 12 Years a Slave. That was partly because it was a British filmmaker, Steve McQueen, and they had some British cast in it, and that helped them in some markets. But it does come into those foreign markets a little bit handicapped.
So tell some of about some of the other ones that are in the works, some other black-themed films.
Well, what's interesting is they're coming together very, very quickly. If a movie typically takes at least 18 months to get together, you've got pictures now, and we're in May, that are just being shot or they're about to be shot that may well make the Oscar season. When I started working on this story, I talked on May 2nd to Margot Lee Shetterly, who told me that that day, that hour, she had just finished the manuscript for a book called Hidden Figures, which is a real-life book about black women who worked in the space program. And that film adaptation has been shooting for about 6 weeks now already in Atlanta, and they will get that out through Chernin Entertainment and I believe Fox, at least onto some screens for consideration at the end of the year. I think there's a movie coming out of A24, which had Room, that's a small, mm-hmm. based on a play called Moonlight, that I'm told by people who have seen it is very strong and is going to sneak up on people's very personal story about young men. Fences, based on the August Wilson play, is being shot right now in Pittsburgh, directed by Denzel Washington. Denzel and Viola Davis have been in the Broadway revival of that play, and they will be in the movie. And Disney has one called Queen of Katwe, which has Lupita Nyong'o in one of the roles, and it's another real-life story about a young African chess player, female. And so, you know, there's really quite a spread.
So are we also seeing a diversity in subject matter? There has been some complaint that a lot of black films are either slave dramas or biopics.
You know, there is some, there's still slave dramas here. There are at least a couple of them, and there are plenty of biopics, so that remains true. But then again, you know, I mean, if you're talking about awards consideration, you're not going to have action pictures and broad comedies. And there are some comedies and things we just didn't list there. I mean, Kevin Hart, who I've been told would love to be an Oscar host, has a concert film coming out at Christmas time that we didn't include the rack up here because it doesn't seem like an Oscar thing. And that'll be at a Universal. But what's interesting to me is the subject matter is quite different than back in the early 90s when there was a very strong run of black film coming forward. You know, those tended to be much more sort of street-driven. Remember John Singleton, before he was 27 or 28 years old, had three green lights out of Columbia. And they were all a little closer to Boys in the Hood. He had Tupac in one of them. And, you know, they were sophisticated films, but they were one step beyond harsh street dramas, which dominated then. Now you're starting to see willingness to break out in a lot of different directions.
Well, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Michael Sipley, LA-based reporter for the New York Times. He covers Hollywood. Julie Myers is here with the feedback.
Yeah, feedback is back.
Hi there.
Hello.
You're not wearing green.
Not today. I'm wearing my horse shirt. There's lots of horses on it. Read nothing into that, Madeline, based on what we covered on our show
today.
Not
a furry. Okay.
No. We also covered the middle class today. And Jose called in. He said that he has a good job. He's an airport mechanic. He bought a house a long time ago. He has a reliable car, and he doesn't live beyond his means, but he feels like he's falling out of the middle class. Nothing really has changed for him, but he feels like in LA, the cost of living has gone up so much that middle class just isn't what it used to be. I asked our listeners on Twitter, what is the one thing that makes you feel middle class? Adrena Gregorian had a one-word answer. She says leverage. I'm guessing that that's the ability to kind of have a little wiggle room in what mm-hmm. you're doing. Justin Sedgwick tweeted that the one thing that makes him feel middle class is going to a chain restaurant for a nice meal on Sunday, but not being able to afford an appetizer.
Oh, wow.
A highly specific example, but I think that a lot of people can identify with that.
All right. I love all these details. Keep them coming. Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.